Well, next hour, we're going to go a little hunting for Mel's hole. We're also going to open up a Fright Night open line. But when we come right back, it's Mark Zachree and the rest of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Mark Zachree and, of course, your phone calls. So how does James do playing the part of Captain Kirk, by the way?
Well, actually, he's quite engaging. It's fascinating because I saw him in the episodes online before I met him, and finally he flew out here and we met with him and 15 of his department heads for New Voyages. And he's got a great swagger, a great bravado. He's really good looking. He's very Kirk-like. I was really pleased. There's a lot to work with, and I think he's got the stuff. I really do. And also the actor who plays Spock is quite good as well, and the makeup on him is very, very good.
Does he look Spocky-ish, I guess?
Yeah, except he's younger and he has blue eyes, whereas Nimoy had brown eyes. But he can do the Vulcan thing, which is great. And but it's very funny because what we're going to do prior to the shoot is we're actually going to fly the New Voyages cast out here and sort of have acting camp for a weekend where we're going to be just working with them as actors and coaching them. And my wife directed Off-Broadway and so forth, and so Elaine and I will be working with them. And also we'll probably have some surprise guests to help coach them who I think will be very impressive to them.
I'm sure you will.
Yeah.
Now, when you say the Vulcan thing, you're talking about putting the hands up?
Well,
that thing?
Well, the funny
the
thing
fingers
is,
split
no,
like that?
It's more than that. It's that most actors don't play Vulcans correctly. They play it very flat. Whereas if you look at Nimoy, he was very expressive and very emotional and easily offended as Spock and so forth. So he's playing a lot of emotions. Kirstie Alley got it right also in Wrath of Khan. But most actors just kind of play it emotionless, and that's not the way to do it at all.
Well, you know, what was so great about the way Leonard Nimoy played Spock is that you knew he had to portray, and his persona was to be unemotional.
Yes.
But he leaked it through on various episodes on purpose, obviously.
Yes.
And it was great. It was like taking this person who acted almost robotic, but really he had feelings about things.
Yes. Well, I think the reason people responded so well to Spock from the beginning was because here's a man who's very intelligent, very commanding, but underneath he's very insecure. I'm talking about the character, of course. And I think a lot of the viewers who felt that they had a lot to offer but were very insecure identified with that character, that sort of wounded soul. And so I think that made him enormously engaging and interesting.
Did they glue his fingers together when he would ever do that? Because I can't do that, Mark. Well, I guess you have to be double jointed to do that.
Well, the interesting thing
can you do
that,
it?
Yeah, well, yes, I can, in fact. And the funny thing is, when they came up with that Vulcan salute, Leonard Nimoy is Jewish, and there's actually a Jewish hand sign that's that sign, and that's how he came up with it. Yes, and so but it's very funny because at the roundtable that I run of actors and writers and directors and producers, one night the stunt woman from New Voyages brought one of the Star Trek tunics, and I put it on, and there was an actress there that evening who had acted in Star Trek and Babylon 5. So the two of us took a photo together doing the Vulcan salute, and it was great fun.
Let's take some phone calls. This hour's going to go by very fast for you. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us, and Mark Zachree. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing? This is Kent from Norfolk. How you doing,
George? Good,
hello.
Kent. Thanks.
How you doing, Mark? I have a question. What advice would you have for us for a budding scriptwriter who wants to get involved in the business? And would you recommend any of the script software programs? And also,
yeah,
my favorite Twilight Zone episode is Nightmare at 40,000 Fathoms.
Yeah, it's a great episode. In terms of breaking in here, well, first of all, the screenwriting program I use is Final Draft, and there's another one called Movie Magic. They're both very good and very easy, those are sort of the industry standards. In terms of breaking in, the best advice I would give you is write stories that entertain you. Write the stories that are not just imitating what you're seeing, but that have something coming from the core of your heart. But also get a hold of screenplays, just see what the format is, so that the format is correct. And then there's something called the Hollywood Creative Directory, and it lists all the production companies in Hollywood and New York and the people who work there, what their titles are. And get a hold of that and read through it with a highlighter and just look at who's doing what and see what companies might be good for your project. and then contact these people. And some of them will, blow you off, but others will be open to what you have to say, and we'll take a look at your work. And so that's not a bad way to get started.
Online, or is it an actual book?
It's online, but they also publish it, and it's the Hollywood Creative Directory, and it's the Producer's Edition.
Producer's Edition. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very
great.
Much.
Great. Good luck to you in your career. Maybe we'll see your scripts on the big screen one day.
Okay, hopefully. Thank you very much.
All right, great. Let's
You're
go
welcome.
To our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, sir. It's all yours.
I have four questions.
Well, hold on. I can only take maybe two.
Well.
Give us your two best.
One is, wasn't Rod Serling originally into politics, but in order to sell the Twilight Zone, he had to use the format of science fiction as a way to get around to dealing with the politics he wanted to put forth?
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't just politics. Basically, in the 1950s, Rod was the top writer working in TV. He was writing for Playhouse 90 and the top shows and writing very hard-hitting, realistic drama. But whenever he wanted to comment on race or social issues or politics or any of that, he was totally censored by the networks and the sponsors and so forth. So he felt very blunted and very gagged in those terms. And so he wrote Twilight Zone so he could write about those issues and disguise it with science fiction and fantasy so that he could get it past the censors and get it to his audience. And that ironically made the stories more timeless. And he certainly got to say what he wanted to say.
So sci-fi was his genre of
yes.
getting around it.
Very much so. And even today, many of us look to those forms to be able to comment about the world we're living in. If you look at a show like Lost, which is sort of almost quasi-fantasy, and J.J. Abrams, who is one of the co-creators and runs that show, he's a huge Serling fan. And so you see them commenting a lot about our world through that sort of fantastic setting.
Just two more, rather quickly. The first episode, Hey, Anyone Out There?
Yeah, where is everybody?
Where is everybody with Earl Holloman?
Yes.
The ending of that had, and it was the very first Twilight Zone, that had to be rewritten because they threw it out because it was too scary. So it had to be like a dreamscape.
Well, because originally what Serling had was an ending where in this fantasy part where he's lost in a town, the astronaut trainee has a little ticket, and then when we realize he was in an isolation experiment, he reaches in his pocket and there's the ticket stub. So that's the little Twilight Zone element. But Rod didn't have that in the final version of the episode, but he did have it in the short story version that he wrote. The reason he wrote the pilot where it was very realistic and very reality based was because the sponsors and the networks that he was trying to sell this to. We're not science fiction fans, so we thought, okay, I'll write something very earthbound to get this past them, and then once I have my series, I'll write the more far-out stories, and that strategy worked.
And there was a remake, I think, back in the 80s of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, they brought it back a couple times. CBS brought it back in the late 80s, and there were some very good episodes of that version. I actually wrote two scripts for them. And then it was also on UPN in a third version more recently, and that really didn't fly. It wasn't a success.
What was the name of the episode with Agnes Moorehead, and she was swiping away at the space travelers?
That's right. That was called The Invaders. It was written by Richard Matheson and directed by my friend Douglas Hayes. And she's a woman who has these two little strange robot-like attackers from outer space. And ultimately, we discover they're actually astronauts from Earth. And it's a great episode.
I loved it. Absolutely. Night Gallery didn't take off too well for Rod Serling, did it?
Well, Night Gallery was a mixed bag because Rod didn't have final control of it. So often they would be throwing out his scripts or changing them in ways he didn't like. There were still a few good episodes. He did a great episode called They're Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar, which is one of my favorites. But Rod was not happy about Night Gallery at all.
And it was pretty dramatic, too, because people expected to see that same Twilight Zone flavor. And we went from black and white to color.
Yeah.
And it was pretty dramatic for people, Mark.
It was. And it's interesting. I recently was speaking at USC, and I showed a walking distance from Twilight Zone and Tim Riley's Bar from Night Gallery. It was very interesting to see because they're companion pieces. They're both out sort of world-weary executives. But the look of Twilight Zone is as good as any black and white feature film ever made. Whereas Night Gallery was much flatter. The colors were bright. But it just didn't have that same quality of execution just visually that Twilight Zone had. Twilight Zone was just gorgeously done.
First time caller line, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
How you doing, George?
Good.
Hi, Mark.
Thank you.
Hi.
First of all, I wanted to say I was looking at your website, and I'm obviously a fan of yours. I just see all the stuff you've worked on, and one of the things I wanted to mention, Friday the 13th, I thought was an excellent series. Far better than the movies.
Yes, well, that was if it had been a show that was just like the movies, I wouldn't have taken the job. I story edited the first season, and it was totally different. They were just using the name to be able to get the show launched, but it was about two cousins who inherit a cursed antique shop, and they spend their time going after these cursed antiques, trying to get them back and stop evil from being committed. So there was a very strong moral stance, and in that way it was very tonally similar to Twilight Zone, and I was able to do a lot of work that I was very proud of.
And I wanted to ask, since you're so up on the history of it, and George was almost there at the time it was on, do you remember a show called Way Out?
Yeah, that was Roald Dahl, and it was actually on the CBS schedule as a lead-in to Twilight Zone for the season that it was on, and it had a lot of very strange stories, and I hope that someday they'll release that on DVD. It was an interesting, dark, very strange show.
It was. Nobody knows of that. I'm surprised. One quick thing. Did you like Millennium?
I only saw a little bit of it. I certainly like Lance Henriksen, and I think he's a wonderful actor, but I didn't watch really enough of the show to get into it or really, really follow it very well, unfortunately.
Oh, that's too bad, because what I wanted to say was I really think Chris Carter, like, abandoned that just because he got too overwhelmed and kept in with the X-Files.
Yeah,
but that show, I thought, was excellent.
Well, you know, it's really a challenge when you're running a number of shows simultaneously, and... But Rod Serling was really the first writer, executive producer, the first one to, prior to Serling, producers were not writers, and the guys who ran the shows were not the writers. And Serling was really the first guy in television drama to run the TV series. And all of these people like Chris Carter, J.J. Abrams, Joe Straczynski with Babylon 5, etc., they're very much following in Serling's footsteps. They all are very aware of the debt they owe him for allowing the writers to have the basically the keys to the car.
Let me test your memory, Mark. Outer Limits, before or after Twilight Zone?
It debuted in 1963-64, and so it was just during the final season of Twilight Zone. It ran for a year and a half. It's a great show. Harlan Ellison wrote for it. Joe Stefano, who wrote Psycho, was also one of the main writers on that show. It's a great black-and-white show, wonderful actors, many of the same actors from Twilight Zone, but a very different tone to it. I like both shows very much.
Science fiction theater, before or after?
That was before, and more sort of technologically oriented, not as emotion-filled and heartfelt as Twilight Zone.
One Step Beyond.
One Step Beyond was just before Twilight Zone. Some of the similar writers, Charles Beaumont, who wrote for Twilight Zone, also wrote for One Step Beyond. And it's very funny because One Step Beyond was ostensibly based on true stories, but Charles Beaumont laughed about that. He said, "Nah, we just made it up."
I loved One Step Beyond, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very fun show. John Newland hosted it, and there's a very funny episode of One Step Beyond where they broke format and did more of a documentary style. They had heard that there were mushrooms down in South America that if you ate them, they gave you psychic powers. And so the host and the crew went down and started ingesting these magic mushrooms and just started rolling around laughing. It's a very, very interesting episode to watch from the perspective of our time now.
You're giggling now yourself, Mark. No mushrooms there for you.
Yes, exactly.
Wildcard line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Bill from Las Vegas.
Hey, Bill. Welcome.
Listening to you on KXNT, 640 AM.
Good to have you with us.
It's always a pleasure. My college history professor was good friends with Rod Serling, and I got to know my history professor pretty well, and we talked about Rod. And as I understand it, Rod was quite a workaholic with Twilight Zone, but he hated Night Gallery.
Yeah.
And I was wondering why... The people that were having him do Night Gallery were not giving him more leeway.
Well, you know, the Universal and the executives running Night Gallery just didn't respect Rod as they should have. Often, it's more about power and arrogance than good common sense and the right creative aesthetic. Certainly, if you know, Rod should have been. I mean, they should have recognized what a genius he was. He was very, very upset. Yeah.
Yes. Well, politics seems to have abounded even then, and it seems to be getting worse. I had one other question pertaining to science fiction theater.
Mm-hmm.
When did that first debut, and how many episodes of it were there? And are there available any on, say, DVD?
Yeah, it was in the mid 50s. It ran for several seasons. I think I've seen it on DVD. So it's worth checking out. Additionally, there's a very early science fiction series called Tales of Tomorrow. There was a Twilight Zone-style anthology, and that is available on DVD, and it's very interesting to watch it and compare it with Twilight Zone. And there's an episode called What You Need that's adapted from the same short story as the Twilight Zone episode of that same name. But Tales of Tomorrow had some great actors. It had Paul Newman and many of the classic actors, so it's well worth checking out.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Okay, appreciate it. I remember Burgess Meredith in at least one Twilight Zone, but I thought he was in two. One where he broke his watch and
That's
everyone
right.
stopped. Wasn't he in that one? And then he was also in another one where he broke his eyeglasses.
That's right.
And he couldn't read books.
He's actually in four episodes. The most famous one is Time Enough at Last, where he's a bookworm who becomes the last man on Earth after a nuclear war, and he breaks his glasses, which was one of the great endings of all the Twilight Zone episodes. He was also in an hour-long Twilight Zone episode called Printer's Devil that's lesser known. He was in two more episodes where they're not as distinctive, but still a lot of fun. It's funny, we're going to be releasing the entire Twilight Zone Companion as an unabridged audiobook through Blackstone, and one of the extras is going to be my complete audio interview with Burgess Meredith when I interviewed
him
for the
book.
Oh, that's
great. He was a great actor.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I went to his house in Malibu, and we sat by the beach, and I interviewed him about all of his Twilight Zone episodes. So he was quite a flinty character, but he was a wonderful actor.
Who played the part then where he broke his watch and then everybody stopped and he was all alone?
Yeah, that was an episode called A Kind of a Stopwatch. And I'm trying to remember the actor's name. He's not a well-known actor now. And
I thought that was also Burgess Meredith.
No, it wasn't. It's definitely a Burgess Meredith kind of role. But he wasn't in that one. But it's funny because a lot of people reference that episode because certain Twilight Zone episodes have such intriguing fantasy elements, and the idea of having a stopwatch that could stop time, you really say to yourself, well, what would happen if I were to do that? What if I got a hold of one of those?
Richard Erdman.
That's right, Richard Erdman. Thank you. And
don't thank me. Thank my producer. I'm only honest here, Mark.
Tom Danheiser is a wonderful man.
He's
and
quick.
One thing that's wonderful is that now you can get Twilight Zone in a definitive box set, and you can watch these episodes and see them uncut and in gorgeous, pristine prints is so much fun.
I have one of my favorite episodes on tape, of course, thanks to you, To Serve Man.
Yes, it's a classic. And it's funny, they've just been marketing Twilight Zone toys, and you can actually get a toy of that Canimit.
I have him.
Alien.
Somebody sent me one, and we posted them on our website with our Digicam, which we've got to start sending some more pictures up on that thing.
That's great.
But I love it.
Yeah, they're wonderful toys. They also have the little invader from the Invaders episode that we were just talking about, the one with Agnes Moorehead. And
is it weird for a 55-year-old man to relish his Kenamite doll?
No, not at all. Not at all.
I'm sick, Mark. I got a problem.
Well, then we share that problem, George.
Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment with Mark Zakrie. We'll take final phone calls, and then next hour we go to our open lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. Couple more weeks to go. The free CD on Perfect Possession on Exorcisms, the longtime interview, Art Bell's interview with the late Father Malachi Martin, is available to you when you subscribe or renew your After Dark newsletter, but it will not be available for long. This is a classic. You can call 1-888-727-5505 to subscribe and get the free CD, or go online, safe and secure, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. Final segment, your phone calls with our very special guest tonight, Mark Zakrie. So, Mark, you have a website and you have a blog.
That's right.
Right?
That's
okay.
Right. And so it's the blog is a very new edition. So it's www.zakrie.blogspot.com. And it's great fun to be putting these entries down on that.
And how soon do you update that? Quite often?
Every few days, yeah. I find it very easy to just put a photograph on and some text. And I talk about Twilight Zone and Bradbury and Star Trek and whatever's going on in my life. And it's funny because I've just been doing this for the last week and a half, 2 weeks or so, and I had no idea that so many interesting things were happening.
Oh, yeah. It's going to turn out to be some kind of little a cult thing for people in Hollywood.
Yeah, I think so. And also, as I mentioned a little while earlier, George, my wife and I mentor writers and directors and producers and actors. In fact, we're going to be in Dallas in a couple of weeks teaching a class. And so frequently people will email us or call us and ask for advice. And because there's so many people giving wrong advice about how to have a career and how to maintain a career in this business, that we just feel it kind of our obligation to pass on what we've learned. And certainly the people who mentored me, Bradbury and Sturgeon and all of those guys, they come from their heart and they maintain their honesty of nature and of outlook. And I think that's very important if you're going to continue as a creative artist in this business.
Doesn't happen very often, Mark.
Well, I've surrounded myself with a lot of guys who've managed to hold on to that, and I feel very blessed.
Yeah, you've got a core of people who are just great people.
Yeah, and you're one of them too. And it's I think these kind of people gravitate toward each other, and I think that's a great part of being in this business.
Back to the phones we go. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark Sicri. Hi there.
Okay, hi George, and hi Mark. Even though the episode Death Ship was a fascinating exercise in uncomfortable psychology.
Yes.
I was wondering, do you think that the fourth season that went to hour-long episodes, did that hurt the series?
Well, I don't know if it hurt the series. They were just trying to expand the audience. Gunsmoke went from a half hour to an hour. Hitchcock Presents went from a half hour to an hour. So they tried it with Twilight Zone. Interestingly enough, when Rod Serling initially conceived of Twilight Zone back in 1957-58, the first few Twilight Zone pilots he wrote, the first three he wrote, were actually hour scripts. One of these was actually filmed at the Desilu Playhouse, and the other two never were filmed. But by the time it went to series, it was a half hour, and Serling actually came to believe that a half hour was the appropriate length. So he did a half season worth of hour-long episodes in the fourth season. Then in the fifth season, they went back to half hours. But there were a few good hour episodes. Death Ship is one of them. In fact, on the definitive Twilight Zone set, I actually did a commentary, an audio commentary on Death Ship, and because it's an episode that I'm very fond of. But
That was a beautiful episode.
Yeah, it was. Yes. But still, the half hour really is the right form for
yes.
Twilight.
And George, I don't know if you have any kids or girls.
Oh, yeah. I've got three kids, and they're all grown. Two are girls, and three grandchildren.
Did you have any girls?
Oh yeah, two of them.
Well, did you remember the episode Little Girl Lost, where she went under the bed and she was lost under the wall?
She went into another dimension.
That's right.
George,
yeah.
I have grown sons, but I have a little girl now, and whenever I watch that episode, I mean, That is a timeless episode.
It's chilling because you can hear her little voice.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Where are you?
That's right. Well, it's funny because the genesis of that episode was Richard Matheson, who wrote it. One night he heard his daughter, Tina, crying, and he went to her room, and she wasn't on the bed, but he could hear her. So he assumed she had just rolled under the bed. So he reached under the bed, and he couldn't feel her, and he could still hear her. And then finally what he did was he reached all the way to the end, to the wall, and she had fallen into the bed and rolled up against the wall beyond his reach, and he was able to pull her out. But that's what got him thinking about, well, what if she fell through a hole in dimensions and was actually in another dimension? And it's a very fascinating episode. And later, the movie Poltergeist, I think, was very inspired by that.
Same thing. Exactly.
Yeah, very much so, yes.
All right, thanks, Jim. Appreciate you being on the program. Next up, West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
My name is Anthony, and I'm calling from just south of the Bigfoot country here near Lassen Park, California.
Sure thing.
And I just have a cute little story about Ray Bradbury. Back when I was in high school in 1973, he was very instrumental in creating our sci-fi club.
Huh.
And he spent many hours at our school. I think he was very good friends with our drama teacher or something. And he came there quite often. And, I mean, we watched Fahrenheit, 451. I mean, you just name it. He was always bringing a film.
Wow.
And he was really instrumental in so many things. And one thing he did for us, it was right around the time of the big fad of Planet of the Apes. And somehow or another, he got some of the casting crew or the makeup crew to come to our high school. And here the Sci-Fi Club was running around campus all day dressed up like these Planet of the Apes characters. But that was all thanks to Mr. Bradbury, well, and I'd met him several times.
Yeah,
I love some of the things he did. Now, he wrote a couple of the Twilight Zone series, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, he wrote an episode called I Sing the Body Electric.
My, one of my favorites.
Yeah, George loves that episode. And he wrote two other scripts that didn't get made, but his proteges, Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont and George Clayton Johnson, were also writers for Twilight Zone. He brought them to the show, introduced them to Rod, and Rod was a huge Bradbury fan. There's two episodes, Walking Distance and Stop at Willoughby, that actually have in-jokes, references to Bradbury in them. In fact, Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up also has a reference. And so these men were all friends, and they all knew each other and hung out with each other, and I was very lucky to meet so many of them. And in fact, when I was working on the Twilight Zone Companion, I came upon audio and videotape of Rod Serling teaching classes in writing, where he would show Twilight Zone episodes and then talk about them. And and these are totally candid moments in Rod's life, so you can actually see what he was like just interacting with people. So both Bradbury and Serling had that same appreciation of people and warmth toward pretty much anyone.
Isn't it sad that some people, some youngsters, haven't had the opportunity to see some of the Twilight Zone episodes?
Yes, yeah, and that's why I think we're really blessed to have home video now, where you can have these episodes and watch them. And I think accessibility of these shows will only continue to grow. And we were talking earlier, George, about iPods and other delivery methods, computers. It's I think that's really, really spreading it and spreading the word. And I have a sister who's 19 years younger than me, and when she was in college, she finally got into Twilight Zone. And when I saw that her generation could enjoy it every bit as much as I could, I knew that the Twilight Zone was going to live a long, 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 long time.
Did you ever have an opportunity to meet Asimov?
I met Isaac Asimov once in my travels, and I've met many of that generation of science fiction writers. And in fact, when I wrote for Deep Space Nine, I wrote an episode where the captain on the space station goes back to the 50s, and he's a science fiction writer, because I wanted to write about that milieu and those and the writers like Asimov and Heinlein and Bradbury and Sturgeon. And so it was a great honor to be able to write about that period. And that was very much inspired by my friendship with Theodore Sturgeon when I was a teenager.
I love his short story about a computer, and it kind of jumpstarts life again throughout the universe.
Yes. Well, these writers had
great minds.
Some phenomenal imaginations, yeah.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George, this is Lyle from San Diego.
Hey, Lyle, welcome to the show.
Hey, I had a question. I met a woman a couple of years ago. Her name was Delan, and she claimed to be Gene Roddenberry's niece. And I was wondering if you had any stories, you know, the character on Babylon 5.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you had any cool stories on how characters get named.
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of the time, you know, we as writers will try and come up with different interesting names, and sometimes you'll have a typo when you're writing. Some kind of your fingers will miss the keys, and you'll come up with something, and you'll say, "Oh, I've got to remember that." R2-D2, of course, was a recording session that was real too. Dialogue to, and George Lucas saw that and thought, oh, that'd be a great name for a robot. With Delenn, it's funny, I started Joe Straczynski in the business, and he and I have worked together many a time, and I wrote for Babylon 5, but I never asked him where he came up with that name. But I did meet Mira Furlan, who played that role, and she's now appearing on Lost, and she's quite a wonderful actress. And so many of the science fiction actors and actresses are just enormously talented. And you also mentioned Gene Roddenberry, and when I wrote for Next Generation, I met him several times as well, and he was, even in the later years of his life, he was always looking to push the boundaries and write about things that were socially adventurous and interesting and challenging. And so he had quite an imagination, and he was really quite a trailblazer.
Well, great.
Oh, yeah.
I think a friend of mine, Mark, she's 69 years old. She's in St. Louis. She skates. She's a great skater, wonderful person.
Wow.
She's like an older sister to me.
Huh.
And she definitely doesn't want me to call her a mother. But she skates with a fellow, older guy, small guy, who she said played R2-D2. Now, is that possible?
Yeah, it's very possible because the actor who played R2-D2 is still around. I think his name is Kenny Baker, and he hits the convention circuit, the science fiction convention, so that's very possible. A lot of these classic actors are still alive. In fact, I'm working now on a project with Ray Harryhausen, who's one of the great legendary filmmakers, and we're in negotiations now with the Sci-Fi Channel to make some of his unmade projects. I've teamed up with the producer of Napoleon Dynamite, and we were even just talking about bringing some of those great actors from the 1950s movies like Anne Francis and Gene Barry and so forth, who are still around and still wonderful, and utilizing them in some of these projects. So I love working with some of these older actors. They're still just absolutely marvelous.
Mickey Carroll, one of the Munchkins from the Wizard of Oz,
wow,
lived in St. Louis.
Huh.
And I don't know if he's still alive or not. I think he is, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, some of these guys last a long time. I have one friend, Norman Corwin, who was one of the great writers of radio, and he wrote the movie Lust for Life, and he's 95. He's still teaching at USC.
Oh, that's so great.
These are miraculous, brilliant, wonderful people.
They stay alive because they work.
Yes, that's right.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi there. This is David from Nuwala, Oklahoma.
Hi, David.
And what an honor it is to talk to you, George and Mark.
Well, thank you.
I'm 41, and I was raised on Star Trek, but I really never heard the answer to this question. I was wondering who created or came up with the idea of the holodeck?
Well, that's an interesting question, and one that's rather, there's some debate on that, because Gene Roddenberry, when Gene created Star Trek: The Next Generation, he came up with the idea of the holodeck, the idea of a room that could create almost any environment. But earlier, many, many years earlier, Ray Bradbury wrote a story called The Veldt, and it was about a house of the future where there was a room that was a children's playroom, and it could create any environment, and the children create an African savanna. And ultimately, the lions in this playroom killed their parents, and deliberately so, because the children are angry at their parents. And certainly Roddenberry was a voracious reader of science fiction. Certainly he had read that story. So that may have kind of been the initial inspiration for the holodeck.
Well, that's pretty cool. Back in 1981, I wrote a short story and sent it into a junior college here in Oklahoma City. And it came in like 14th. Out of 27,000 entries.
Wow.
And then I sent it into Amazing Science Fiction, and the editor of the magazine sent me back a handwritten letter saying, we no longer need any more of your ilk sent to us. And yeah. I thought it was kind of odd that he would send me a handwritten letter instead of just a form letter, you know, politely saying, you know, please don't send any more, or we're not interested in this piece.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, you hit these odd bounces, and it's really strange. I mean, as a writer, the main thing is you just have to keep putting your work out there until you find the person who's going to respond to it, and you just have to have the hide of a rhinoceros ultimately.
All right, great. Thanks for your call. So who in Star Trek said the one is not worth more than the many?
Well, yeah, that's that was Spock.
You got it.
Yeah, you bet. And that's
great line.
Yeah, and Wrath of Khan. And it's funny because now that I'm writing Star Trek for New Voyages, I've been watching a lot of the original episodes and the movies, and there's so much wonderful material. In fact, I have a script. There was a script for Star Trek VI, the motion picture that never got made. It was back in Starfleet Academy with young Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And my friend Michael Reeves had a copy of that, so I'm going to be reading that shortly too, the unfilmed Star Trek movie. So it's great stuff.
Have you noticed that phrases or sayings, when they're in film, movies, maybe radio, commercials, will catch on, and then they go all around the country?
Yes, it's true. Well, Twilight Zone, just the phrase Twilight Zone was one of those, because before Rod created that or coined that for his show, there was really no expression for I turned a corner and suddenly I was in a totally different reality. There was really nothing you could plug into that, and then it was like Twilight Zone. It was perfect, and it became a new vocabulary phrase.
My line producer Tom and I have a bet on how long it would take for this word, I'm going to tell you about it, to go around the country. You know how people say excellent about mm-hmm. so many things. We want to change that to Maximus, and I don't know why. We just want to, but we want to see how long it takes to catch on.
Go for it. I'll do my best.
You start. From now on, your work is Maximus.
Well, I've always believed that, George.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We are well. Thank
Great.
You.
It's an honor to be on such an informative program tonight. I'm
well,
really
you.
Enjoying it.
Appreciate it.
I just want to talk about what I felt was my favorite episode of The Twilight Zone, and that's when they had that musical performance where they went, "Up the bilingual Frankis that we once known has been forgotten. And the Earl Farrell way of life is almost gone." Do you guys remember that episode?
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I don't. it was hard to hear with the music being so distorted. So, but there was a number of Twilight Zone episodes that utilized different musical phrases and different songs. There was a really strange episode called "Come Wander with Me" that starred Gary Crosby, Bing Crosby's son, as a pop singer who goes into the backwoods looking for a folk song and falls afoul of that.
That poor guy, if he had produced that show, would have been one of the lowest-rated programs ever.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Next up, East of the Rockies. Let's go to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good morning, George, Mark, Dan from Mobile.
Hi, Danny. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if you guys are old enough to remember Commander Corey's Space Patrol.
Oh, of course. Of course. There's a wonderful book about the making of Space Patrol that's just come out by Jean-Noël Bassoir, and it's a wonderful show. It was from 1950 to 1955. It was aired live, and it starred Ed Kemmer as Commander Buzz Corey. And in fact, when I wrote for Babylon 5, I created a character called Ed Kemmer as a tip of the hat to Space Patrol. It's a marvelous show. Ed Kemmer had been a fighter pilot in World War II, and so he brought that. He was a real life hero, and he brought that quality to the role. So it's a show I feel great fondness for.
Yeah, I actually got to go aboard that ship.
Wow,
it was at Artesia and Hawthorne Boulevard.
Huh.
Over there in Hawthorne, in the mall. That was before the mall. They built the mall.
Huh.
What's your setting going to be for your Star Trek, The New Voyages?
What's the setting going to be?
Yeah.
Well, it takes place on the original Enterprise, and we're also going to be building the Excelsior, which is Captain Sulu's ship 30 years later, and it's going to have Kirk, Spock, McCoy. It's very funny just to be writing on a page. We've written about 50 pages of the script so far.
Cool.
And
can you use the old sets?
Well, they've rebuilt all of them.
Oh, you're kidding!
Yeah, they're gorgeous. Well, here's the story behind it, which is James Cawley.
30 seconds, Mark. So yeah. You got to do this fast.
He worked in wardrobe on Next Generation. Met the guy who had worked on the original show. Got all the blueprints and rebuilt all the original sets. They're terrific.
That must have cost a fortune.
I think it was love and hard work.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. Well, they're pros out there in Hollywood when it comes to set design, aren't they?
Yeah, you bet.
Well, Mark, first of all, good luck to you on that. And do let us know when it's all ready to go and how people can view it. Like you said, it's going to start on the web. But who knows? Might get picked up by cable or commercial television.
You never know.
You never know. Mark Zachary. And we'll be back in a moment. We've got a couple hours now of open lines for you. I'm going to open up a fright line for you. I'll tell you about that when we come right back. And also, we're going to get a brief update on the search for Mel Waters, Mel's Hole, up there in Washington. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.